Yes.
This recording. Testing.
Maybe we should close the door so that he doesn't. Should we have to move in? No. You mean the chair? Yeah. Yeah.
I'm comfortable with it. Whatever.
It's okay.
Right.
It'll be like this. Hello.
Maybe we can start. So thank you very much for being here today. I think probably most of you got the email announcing Troy's talk today, and you read that he created a project called Restorative Media. He will be telling us about it, and the mission of his project is to help black women and men coming out of prison to kind of find their way back in society, as well as young people at risk of going to jail. And he's also working with law enforcement officers to educate them about the importance of their interactions. And so Troy will be talking to us about his project and also his life. He was incarcerated in San Quentin, and while he was there, he joined the Sangha. He started meditating, he was telling me this morning, in 2005. He started meditating in 2005 while he was in solitary confinement, and then he joined the Sangha, and he's been practicing ever since. And he will be telling us about, you know, how the practice has helped him to transform his life. Anyway, I shouldn't talk more because he's the one who should be. Thank you for thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you for inviting me, and thank Mary Jane for making so many good connections in my life. So thank you too, and thank you, the Sangha, for having me here. So I guess I'll start with where I'm at now. 2 years ago, I paroled from San Quentin after serving 18 years of a life sentence. And the thing about a life sentence is that you never know when or if you're ever coming home, so there's a lot of hopelessness to a degree in that. And the truth is that but for the big mortgage crisis and the tech bubble that burst in 2008, I probably wouldn't be home. I have the type of history and criminal background that that would have continued to be used as a reason never to let me out of prison. I was serving a life sentence with the possibility of parole, which meant that we had to go before a board of prison hearings in order to be found suitable for parole. And what that looks like is that you walk into this room and there's like this big conference table, maybe 10 feet long, and there's a deputy commissioner and a commissioner sitting on the other side of this table. The district attorney is on this big telescreen prompter that's kind of sitting over here off to just outside of my peripheral vision. And the first time I walked in in shackles. I walked in hands and feet shackled, and there's two guards standing behind me, and my attorney is to my right as well. You can imagine that's already kind of setting up this big scenario where it's very intimidating and kind of hard to explain how you transformed, how you turned your life around. In addition to being in most of the prisons that I was in early on, were pretty violent, like violent places. So couple that with somebody going to prison in a violent state, being housed in this violent environment, and yet trying to figure their way out. Seems like a very hopeless situation, right? And yet, early on, I think my biggest problem with going to the board was my own inability to express my transformation in a way that they could get it. To express how, what tools that I used to stay out of trouble in this violent environment. And like, and when I'm, just to explain the environment a little bit more, it's like, imagine being in the, in your home where everything is just so peaceful and the door is closed and you get ready to go walk out. And as soon as you open up that door and step out, it's like stepping out into a portal into Baghdad at the height of the war. And you have this American uniform on, and yet you're not allowed to have a pistol. And you have to maneuver your way through this environment. Right, that's what it felt like to me in many cases. And yet, like there is a way. I ended up in solitary confinement after a prison riot broke out. Not that I got caught up in the prison riot, but afterwards, people use that as an excuse to drop a kite, which is an anonymous note, and they told the guards that I had socked the guy in the face and that he immediately ran down to the officer station. And so all I know is I'm sitting on my bunk and the two officers walk up, they tell me to stand up, they cuff me up, and they take me to lockup. I really don't even know why at the time. So here I am in lockup, and now I have to fight. I have to figure out a way to fight. Utilizing my, I became a paralegal when I was inside, so utilizing my paralegal skills, trying to fight that way, to try to figure out how is it that somebody could just drop an anonymous note, write an anonymous note, and that wound me up in lockup. Without any recourse, without any way of challenging what had been said, and not even fully knowing what had been said. All I knew is that there was an accusation. And I'm going to come back to that in one moment, but just here I am in lockup and I'm trying to fight this situation. So while in lockup, there's a misnomer that you get out 23 hours a day. That's not true. If you get out twice a week, you're lucky, right? If there's a problem or something going on in the unit, you might not get out, right? So you're in a cell, and some of the cells that I've been in, like this is the back wall, this is the other wall. That's what you're sitting in. And so it's blacked out. The windows, there's a small, maybe 4-inch slot window that's maybe 3 feet tall and 4 inches wide, but it's painted from the outside. And so you can't see. You're just in that room. There's a cooling system in there and it just blowing cold air. And so it's freezing inside. One of the things I used to do, there was a crack in the paint on the outside so I could look up I would wake up early in the morning, because after a while you start to lose track of time. And I would wake up early in the morning and I would look outside and I would see all the birds lined up on this telephone wire. And it's like every morning at the same time, these birds would just line up. And it's almost like they were having their own form of prayer, because it seemed like every bird within wherever, they just would come and they would just be there. Like literally, it felt like, seemed like thousands of birds just would come and line up, and they would all be facing the same direction. And so I just started to notice little things like that. And we would have to take toilet paper and try to block the vents up to try to stop some of that cold air from coming through. But inside there, you know, it's a, prison's already a pretty lonely place. My first 10 years there, I can count maybe five people that I could actually have a real conversation with, that I could actually feel comfortable enough to talk about what I was going through with my kids, not knowing where they were at, or, you know, broken relationships and everything else. So prison can be already a lonely place, and then at the extreme of that, and going to in solitary confinement, and wanting to find an escape, but not being able to really find one. So in the past, you know, humans and myself included, you know, anger was my form of escape. That's the way I escaped the reality of what I was going through. I would lash out at people, or some people do drugs, some people drink, people do a lot of things not to really face themselves. But sitting in there, initially I thought I was going crazy, because I would think people were calling me. And so I would get up and go to the door and I'd be like, hey, you call me? And they'd be like, man, nobody's called you. Because that was our only form of communication, was either shouting through the door, or we would make these, we would make strings, and you could, we call it fishing, right? So you can make a string, you get the bottom piece of a flat, like the old karate shoes they used to hand out, that's kind of what they give you in there. So you chop it up and you tie a string to it, and you can throw a line out your door, and people to help get that line all around to the other side. So if somebody was hungry or somebody wanted something, they would send the line around to one of their friends, and we'll attach a string to it, and then just drag the line back. And I'm literally from one, it's like sending the line from here around the outside to where the kitchen is at, right? Like guys would get really creative, and you have to help each other. So it broke, actually being in the hole, in one sense, broke down a lot of the racial barriers, because you needed other people. And if those of you don't know, prison is probably one of the most racist places on the planet. Like you can literally get stabbed just for walking through somebody else's area. And you're white, you look white, something happens on the prison yard, you don't get to say, I'm not involved, I'm just trying to do my time and go home. No, you will be attacked, and vice versa, right? So there's a lot of that happens there. So I'm sitting in there, and I'm trying to figure out how to escape. I need to get away, and I can't get away. There's nowhere to run but inward. And I remember one of the first books I read about meditation. I had heard about meditation, but one of the first books that I ever read about meditation that had a little piece of meditation in there was written by a guy named Bo Lozoff. It's called We're All Doing Time. And he had these little meditation things that was in there that I actually had used and played with a little bit when I was in reception center. And I just remembered that feeling that I had from actually just sitting and watching and controlling my breath. And so here it is. It's like my only method of getaway is to try to go inside. So I would sit up every day. I would go to the back, clean the little toilet area of the cell, and I had an extra blanket and some stuff. I would just make that. That became my temple, I guess you can say. And you know, the cells are so small, it was hard to sit on the bunk and try to, because there's a top bunk, and so you can't really sit up to meditate. So I would make that new spot every night, and I would go sit. And sitting sort of became my movie. Initially, I usually tell people I started meditating for all the wrong reasons, because in my mind, I was searching to find out whose fault it was that I was in that situation. So I had a sheet of paper in the hole. You have a little pencil. They give you a little pencil like this, and paper is kind of premium. So I had like one sheet of paper. I had a little pencil, and I would sit down every day and I would just start meditating and thinking about whose fault it was that I was in the situation that I was in. And I made me a list, because all them people were going to hear from me one day about why I was in this situation. And so I sat down. Yep. It's my mama's fault. Yep. It's my daddy's fault. Shouldn't have beat me. Yep. The teacher's fault. She didn't give me all that I needed in school. Yep. Oh, it's that guy's fault, right? If he hadn't been talking trash, he wouldn't have got his mouth bust, right? So I'm going through my whole list, and it was kind of a sweet getaway, because it was actually my way of leaving that environment. My mind like transported me outside of that environment, and after about 30 days, like I ran out of names, right? So I had this sheet of paper, and I was writing real tiny, so I had written all the names at the top. And I had all these names on there. And the 30th day, I ran out of names, and I'm like, somebody's missing. Right? Oh, yeah, it seems obvious now, right? So I'm like, I need to figure this out. And for 3 days, I sat and no visions came to me. I couldn't think of, like, I couldn't figure this out. And I'm like, I'm going to start over. So I put a little line through the middle. And I went and sat down. And I couldn't have been sitting down no longer than 3 to 5 minutes. And my name popped up. And I'm quickly like, nah, that can't be right. I don't have anything to do with this. Right? And something told me, just get up and write your name down. Just write your name down. The only way you're going to get past this moment is if you write your name down. So I got up, I wrote my name down, and I looked at the sheet of paper. I had all these names on the top. There was a line through the middle, and my name was on the bottom. And it was like a mathematical equation, and I was a common denominator. And so for the first time, I really started to take a deep look in what I had in common with all these situations. Even if I felt the other person was 99% wrong, what was my 1%? And I started to look for that. And that became very free. It became very, very free, because I realized how much of my power I had actually given away. And how much I allowed myself to be controlled by my emotions instead of me controlling my own emotions. And it's not that I don't get angry. It's not that these things don't come up. But when they do come up, they don't control me. I just try to understand what it is they're trying to communicate to me. And then I developed a very different relationship with my own state of being. And I'm going to back up just a little bit, because all of what I'm saying is in no shape, form, or fashion, in my understanding today, to minimize any of the things that I did to get to prison, right? None of that, like, is to undermine or to minimize any of that. Like, I grew up, and this is not an excuse, But I grew up influenced by gangs at the age of 13 years old. And I grew up with that lifestyle that this is the hand I've been dealt and I'm going to get you before you get me. And as ironic as this may seem to a lot of people, it was very difficult for me to understand why was it okay for America to go to war to protect its own, but not okay for me to go to war to protect my own. So I had the attitude and I felt I was no different from any other soldier. Something happened, you come bomb my twin towers, I'm gonna go bomb your twin towers, now what? Right? And so I took on that gang mentality that I actually see our government taking on. No justification looking back, but that was my mindset, right? Everybody was telling me to be peaceful, but I couldn't walk down the street without seeing violence. I couldn't turn on the television without seeing violence. I couldn't turn on, I even seeing people fighting in Congress. So it's like, how you gonna tell me not to be violent, turn the cheek, but nobody's turning the cheek? Where are my examples at? And so, I saw strength in a group of guys who actually came to my rescue when I was getting jumped and beat up at 13 years old. I was on the way to the store for a loaf of bread and some milk, and these group of guys hit me up. I'm 13 years old. One of the guys got a beard, so I don't know how old he was, but this guy had a full beard. He's like, "Where you from?" "I ain't from nowhere." "Where you living?" "I stay over there." "Well, you must be from this gang." "I don't gangbang." "Yeah, you do. We want to fight." "We can fight. You know, there's four boys in my family. I've never been afraid of a fight. We can fight, but we're not going to be fighting because I gangbang, because I don't gangbang." They didn't want to hear. They end up chasing me, jumping me, beating me up. And at the time that they were chasing me, though, I had an opportunity to run to the police station, which was maybe 100 yards away, or try to make it to the other side of the park where I knew they wouldn't go because the rival gang was on that side of the park. I chose not to go to the police station because of an interaction that I had with police at the age of 7. So my distrust for the police was actually more than my distrust for gangs were. I got confronted by the police at 7 years old and accused of burglarizing something. And I'm like, I don't even know what that word means. And that whole confrontation where they told me I would never see my parents again, and they just like really was traumatizing at 7. So that quickly allowed me to understand why people in my community did not trust the police. So when they chased me, I tried to make it to the other side of the park. Needless to say, I didn't make it. And guess who came to my rescue? That rival gang. From that day forward, I was attached to that gang. Right? And I was attached to them. There were already things going on in my own home where I felt sort of like the black sheep with my family. I didn't feel like I had a voice there. I didn't feel like I could be heard there or seen there. And when this gang came up and rescued me, they actually wanted to know how I felt. The only problem that their solution to how I felt was violence. But they actually cared enough to know how I felt and what I was thinking. They actually, which I took as an act of love, cared enough to protect and support me. Right? And that is, once I got into that, it's like 13-year-old having a 30-year-old man put a pistol in his hand and say, "This is how you be a man. This is how you stay down for the neighborhood. This is how you protect yourself." And I grew up living in that mentality for quite some time. It wasn't until really got older, and the things that happened for me in the hole, in lockup, that had me start doing my own internal reflection, that I came to see beyond a lot of the things. I came to actually identify with how my behavior, things that I had did, had put a bunch of people unnecessarily through a lot of stuff. And but for my practice, I would not be alive right now. And I can give you two recent incidents that happened in my life. One of them as soon as last night. Last night, I was threatened by a man last night who, and I don't understand what his conversation was about, but he felt a need to threaten me and ask me to walk outside to fight him. Now, the old me, the moment you say something crazy to me, I'm going to sock you in your face, and I'm going to realize that I socked you in your face because you fight me back. That's the old me. I was so impulsive. The moment that I felt a threat, I'm immediately going to squash that threat. But when he asked me to go outside and fight, and he looked at me crazy afterwards because I said, no. And he's like, what? He's like, I'm not going to fight you. Right? I'm not going to fight you. Like, this doesn't make sense. Like, now, you can't touch me. If you, I'm not, you know, you put your hands on me. Trust me, I've been fighting since I was 10. I know what I'm doing. It's not going to be easy for you if you put your hands on me, but I'm not going outside to fight you. That's not going to happen, right? So whatever it is that's going on, we can talk about it, we can work through it, but I'm not going to just go fight you. And the reason why I say that involves my practice, because it involves me being aware and being mindful of what's happening inside of me. The moment that, and trust me, I got angry instantly as soon as this guy started, because he called me all, I was every name in the book, and I still to this day, I've been wrestling all morning still trying to figure out what that was about, and I just, it's his stuff. I can't take on other people's stuff, right? But me quickly being able to assess what I'm feeling and what I'm going through helps me distance myself from a reaction that will not be good for both of us or for anybody. The other incident that happened is I was out on the lake in Coalinga. It's a little small lake, and my friend's canoe went over. And quickly got into a panic trying to save him because he told us he could swim. And the way he went over and went into the water, it was clear that he could not swim. And, you know, I can swim enough to save myself, but I'm not a rescue swimmer. And I've actually been told by a lot of people that one of the worst things you can do is swim up on a drowning man or a drowning person, because they will snatch you under with them. And so I'm trying to angle my own canoe to get around to him. And as I'm trying to angle to get around, my canoe goes over. When my canoe goes over, that freezing water zaps you. And when I came back up, I saw the shoreline, and I just started swimming for the shoreline. And as I closed my eyes and started swimming, I was actually sitting in the sangha at San Quentin. And that's the image that stayed in my head until I got to the shore. And once I got there, and I felt the gravel beneath my feet and my hands, I came up, and then it's like reality popped back into being, and we turned our attention to try to save our friend, but we couldn't save him. We couldn't save him. So in one sense, I know being able just to calm myself down enough to make it to the shoreline was helpful to save my life. And even after he passed away, sometimes it can be hard to deal with that trauma or to deal with the guilt, at least feelings of guilt, as though I could have done more. And I think a lot of us were faced with that. So, I mean, I just wanted to point out those are two things that I think recently, most recently in my life, that for me confirms my practice. When I was inside, after I ended up leaving the lockup, I was transferred to San Quentin. And inside, in 2006, I was transferred to San Quentin, and then I heard they had a sangha there, and immediately joined the sangha just to have a community to sit with. In 2007, Discovery Channel came in with Radical Media, and Bruce Sanofsky, who is an award-winning documentarian, they came in and they took us through this film school. After film school ended, they left us the equipment, right? They literally left us better stuff than what they were using to film the documentary that they did on us. So that gave me an opportunity. After they left, we petitioned to Wharton to allow us to keep using the stuff, and we started creating films and creating stuff inside the prison. And that really gave me a voice, in the sense that I think I've always longed to have a voice in my life, even as a little kid. And we started filming all of these events around the prison. I created this show called the San Quentin Prison Report, which turned into both video and radio. And I paroled. And that program is still going on. And our goal behind that was to tell the stories that aren't being told, to talk about the things that people aren't hearing about prison, about life inside a prison. Because a lot of times the public just hears when something bad goes, they hear there's been a riot, you know, they hear about that one incident, and the public assumes that that's the way everything is inside. But there are those little pieces that's inside of, for every one incident that the public hears about, there's actually been maybe about 100 incidents that people have diffused. Even in the worst prisons I've been in, which can be pretty bad. I gotta say, there's no sugarcoating that. But there's always a group of peacekeepers that's going around trying to put out fires, right? I think what enables a lot of it is not having support, right? Not when people are left in this homeless, hopeless situation, and they don't feel anybody cares, it's hard to care for anybody. It wasn't until actually after when I got to San Quentin, I started participating in a lot of these different self-help groups. And it wasn't until people actually began empathizing with me that I actually truly learned how to empathize with other people, right? I remember one of the groups I'm in, we have to share a crime that I was in. We have to share a crime impact statement. And this crime impact statement basically where you lay out your crime. You talk about what you did to get to prison and all the things that happened in your life that led you to get into prison. And the lady that was facilitating, she looked at me, and one of her first words was, "You must have been through a lot in life." To have somebody see that and empathize with that, when what I expected was all the disdain and disgust that I received from everybody else. From everybody who says, from a young kid, "You can't do it. You won't be able to do this." From the school textbooks who, and if any of you are teachers, I wholeheartedly encourage that we look at what's being taught in our textbooks, especially to our young African American people. I'm tired, for one, of just reading in textbooks that my history simply consists of slavery. Whenever they talk about Africa, they talk about it as though it's some backwards bush country. Right? And you can have the same profile from somebody from Africa and the same profile of somebody in their indigenous getup from Europe, and they'll romanticize Europe and they'll talk with disdain about Africa. And so that spoke volumes as a kid growing up. That spoke so much, coupled with all the other things that went into how I started to view the world and view myself or my place in the world. And so when people started to empathize with me, it actually enabled me to open up and start to empathize with other people. In the sense that one part of this group, there's what they call a surrogate victim panel that comes in. So the charge that what I did to get to prison was I participated in a takeover robbery of a computer parts company. So myself and four other guys armed with weapons ran into this computer parts place, held everybody at gunpoint, and started to load a 40-foot bobtail truck up with computer parts, the CPUs at the time that they were using. The police came and we fled. I ran in one direction, me and another guy ran in one direction, and the two other guys ran in the opposite direction. And the guys that ran in the opposite direction, they ran into another business, forced the guy out at gunpoint, and forced him to his truck, and then carjacked him for his truck. So as a result of my participation in the robbery, I was also found guilty of aggravated kidnapping during the commission of robbery, and that's what gave me a life sentence. Also, keep this in mind that, and I'm kind of giving you, I know I'm kind of all over the place a little bit, but, or maybe I am or not, but part of what was so difficult for me to come to terms with that was that I was the only guy that was sentenced to life in prison. Not even the guy who actually did the kidnap received a life sentence. So that was just another element that was just hard for me to fathom. If they said he's not guilty of it, and they know I wasn't there, how can I be guilty of it? Well, another thing about our system is that our system is not always fair, because what they wanted me to do initially was they wanted me to provide evidence against the other two guys, and when I didn't, I'm the one who received the life sentence. Now, once again, I say this not absolving myself from my responsibility, but and accepting my actions and my choices for what I did. And at the same time, I think there are a lot of things that's happening in our environment, in our society, that needs changing, that needs to be addressed. There's a lot of fear mongering that happens about who people are that are coming home from prison as well. People assume that there's one type of person coming home from prison. And they also hear the 70% recidivism rate with regards to prison. And they say, wow, what's wrong with these guys? Like, why are these people coming home and 7 out of 10 are going right back to prison? We might as well just leave them there. But let's look at it a different way. If you ran a company, say you were Chevy Motors, and 70% of your vehicles came back broken, right? You wouldn't be in business for long. So how is it that the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation cannot be providing people the tools that they need to actually transform their lives and continue to be maintain themselves in business, right? And the reason why I say business, because prison is a business. Prison is actually a $10 billion business, right? I don't know how many people have watched the documentary 13th, right? One of the first things the older guy told me when I got to the prison yard was, welcome to the new slave ship. And he handed me a sheet of paper that was a photocopy of the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution. And the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution, and I'm paraphrasing, but it says, slavery shall be abolished except after being duly convicted of a crime. That is the 13th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America. And so we were told slavery was abolished, but in actuality, it just took another form. And so this documentary walks people through the history of that. After slavery ended, then came the vagrant laws, then came the lottery laws, then came Jim Crow, the black codes, and then Jim Crow. Then came all these other systems to sort of continue to oppress people of color. Right. And the same thing is happening. It's just taking on a different face or a different label. But it's the same oppression. It's the same thing. And so it's like, how do we move forward? I think one way of moving forward is us not being blind to what's actually going on. Right? Us actually learning more about each other. Us actually accepting these conversations and accepting that when somebody talks about the system or they talk about white supremacy or white oppression, that you ever heard the saying that if you throw a rock in a pack of dogs, the one that howls is the one that got hit? Right? And so when people call this stuff out, like, we have to be willing to stand up for it and say that this is not what we're going to do or continue to do in this country. Everybody I talk to now knows we're in some hard times right now, right? And it's mostly people coming from, and I just, forgive me if I'm going too far, but it's mostly people that I talk to more so, you know, in white communities that are like, man, this is really bad, it's really worse. And most of the people in black communities are saying the same thing that I've been dealing with for 400 years, right? So, and I'm not saying that's good or bad, and it's, in fact, it might be good in the sense that people are starting to realize and see, like, what is going on. And I think that that's a good thing, that we can open up and have more conversations and more dialogues about different things. So, and I'm going to forward up, and I love for people to ask questions if you have any questions, but I want to say that part of me coming home, or even building what I built inside and coming home to start my media company now, is to create documentaries and create stories that are like giving people a peek into what people go through, have gone through in our prison industrial complex. Even inside, people assume that people aren't coming home with skills. Well, my last 7 years there, I worked as a video technician, which means I produced all the media. There's probably not much that came out of, with regards to media, that came out of San Quentin between 2007 and 2014 that I didn't have something to do with. And guess how much I got paid an hour? I got paid 37 cents an hour to be a video technician. Right? I spent 18 years in prison at a rate, it cost $60,000 to $65,000 to keep somebody in prison a year, every year. When I paroled, I was given $200 and told good luck. The day that I paroled, I was told, you need to report to the parole agent's office within 24 hours. I'm like, okay, where's the parole agent's office? They was like, in Oakland. Okay, where's Oakland? I'm new to the Bay Area. I don't know anything about it, right? And so I find my way there. And I eventually get to the transition housing place that I was living in. And the moment I walked up on the street, there was prostitutes on the corner. There was piles of trash that looked like it was a garbage dump on the corner. And right next door to the transitional house was the dope spot. And so my first thought was, where have they put me and what are they trying to do to me? Because I felt like I was walking into another setup. And quickly, because of the tools that I had developed and because of my practice, I was able to just go inside and understand what it was that I was feeling. Because my first instinct is survival. And my instinct for survival meant that if I'm in this place like this, I need a pistol. Because I kept a pistol on my hip at all times when I was, my whole time prior. Like, there probably wasn't a day that I didn't have a gun on my hip, in a holster. And so my mind went there and I was able to acknowledge and say that this is me trying to protect myself. What other means do I have of protecting myself? And just going inside and like doing that work, which is not easy sometimes. So I just wanted to share that. I think that is important. But I realized that I needed to quickly put me together a support team. I'm thankful to, you know, thousands of volunteers that actually go inside San Quentin to provide support for people inside. And I was able to call up a lot of people. Like, I know a lot of people. And people have rallied around me, and I would not be, I say that this is about joy, right? Because but for those people who rallied around me and gave me that support, I would not be in the position that I'm in. And I only can imagine how hard it is for people who don't have a tenth of the support that I have. Who don't have a fraction of that support. Right. The first time I was married when I came home, I met a woman who about a year before I got out, and we had a whirlwind thing, and I ended up getting married in prison, which was not a good idea. was not a good idea at all. But when I came home, the first night that I spent at her house, in the middle of the night, she touched me. Now, I had been in prison for 18 years. If somebody's touching you in the middle of the night, something's wrong. It's not good. So, and I tried to explain that. She couldn't wrap her head around it. Right? There's a lot of, like, it's not just our veterans that have post-traumatic stress. And on that note, I think the point that I was making earlier that I didn't actually complete is that there's more than one type of person that's coming home from prison. I tend to categorize them as four different types that are coming home. You have the short-termers, right? And the guys that do life on installment, right? Those are the majority of the guys that make up that 70% recidivism rate. The short-termers are guys that they just there for a couple of years. There's not really a need for them to do any type of internal introspection. So they just go and they do their time and they come home. And it is what it is. The guys that do life on installment, they're pretty slick. Them the ones who think they're too slick for their own good. So they kind of run in and out with the idea that they gonna do crime better the next time. And then you have a lot of guys who were sentenced under three strikes. A lot of guys who, in some cases, rightfully so, felt that they were more wronged by the system. And yet, there still was no need for them to do that internal reflection because, the system owed me. I don't owe the system anything. And then there are the guys who had life with the possibility of parole that are coming home. And the majority of these guys, they're home, they're running businesses. I picked a guy up yesterday who came home after 26 years in prison. I called him when I was in the bathroom over there. And this is his first night home. I was talking to him this morning. I was like, "How you doing?" He was like, "I didn't sleep at all last night." He's like, "I maybe slept an hour because you're in this, it's like, it feels strange. And just different." And the guys who have spent life in prison, you know, I knew going into prison that I had to figure some things out. I didn't know how that was going to happen, but I knew I had to try to figure some things out. And so my time was done differently. And I'm not saying that to say that, like, people should be given life sentences, but I think that people should actually be given opportunities for transformation. And I think that if we have a system that doesn't provide those opportunities, society has to remember that then people are coming home. Like, whether you like it or not, they're coming home. So if you just put somebody in a cage and, you know, the fallacy was that you put them in the cage, you're going to throw away the key. Well, that's not so. People are coming home. And so it's like, how do you want people to come home? Because, you know, politicians and people, they sort of blur the lines, right? Even when they enacted Prop 66, like, they, which was, you know, supposed to be about safety or what have you, they sort of, like, blur the lines and they say, they put up the face of somebody that's on death row, and it's like, you know, do you want this guy out of prison? Well, that guy, he's not coming home. That's not the guy who's coming home, right? It's these other guys. We don't want guys to have these and be in prison like they're living a good life in prison. No, but, and then they put up Charles Manson's face. But Charles Manson's not coming home. It's all these other thousands of men who are just sitting on the prison yard with nothing to do, with no education, just sitting there languishing, that's building up resentment and hatred for society because society hated me, right? That a lot of guys' attitude in that situation is that desperation and hope. And it's like, I can't do nothing in here, right? But I'll be damned if I let somebody treat me like this when I come home. And so they come home with them attitudes. And if we just give people a little bit of compassion, a little bit of empathy, that's what comes home. Like, that's what comes back. Most people go on that lifestyle, go down that journey because they don't feel connected to the rest of society. They feel like they're at odds with society, that society is odds with them, so they form their own little bands. They form their own little subcultures, and they go live that life feeling that they're different. And it's not until we really begin to understand somebody's story, what happened to them. Like, I ask people in my situation, or I say that, how is it that I literally, as a young kid, I had so much reverence for life that I would not step on an ant to being a gun-toting, pistol-packing, gang-banging fool willing to put a gun to somebody's head and rob? How does that happen? And until we begin to take a look at that, then we're going to continue to be at odds with each other. We're going to continue to see that, think that we need to build more fences instead of tearing fences down. And so I can just go on and on, but if people have questions, please feel free to ask me anything. If it's too personal, I know how to say no. Yes.
Well, I just want to say thank you so much for sharing your story with us. It's just, I have a million questions, but one question that I have, it was said in your little bio that you also work with police officers trying to
Absolutely.
Help them to change the way that they interact with people. And how does that work? I mean, how are you finding that as a practice?
So one particular thing that, two things jump out of mind when you ask that question. I spoke before the former intern police chief, Howard Jordan's class. And in that class, I told him about my first interaction with the police and how, because of that first interaction, that when I was 13, I chose to run the gangbangers way as opposed to, I could have been a police officer, right? I just was looking for somebody who showed me some, I would have attached myself to anybody at that time. But because of that first incident, that actually ended up altering the trajectory of my entire future, which meant that it also altered the trajectory of people that I came in contact with. And so, normally, like, and it depends, like, cause sometimes I walk into class and I have on a suit and tie and, people won't know who I am. And I ask them, what do you think I do for a living? And people, I get a lot of football coach kind of deal. you know, I get that a lot. But people don't really know what I do. They don't know who I am. They don't know I could be Detective Williams walking in the door. They don't know. In fact, going in the juvenile hall one day, the guy asked me if I left my badge at home. And I was like, yeah, I left it at home. He was like, all right. They were like, who sent you down here? And I'm like, the probation chief. He was like, he's clear, let him in. but that's one thing, is that I let them know that every interaction they have, especially with young people, will end up dictating how that person continues to interact with them and other people. The other thing that's happening is that we have these barbershops. We call them our barbershop meetings. We're actually having one on the 7th where a group of us formerly incarcerated men sit down with police officers, and we just engage in community dialogue. And we just, you know, we try to keep it, you know, as real as we can. Like, this is what happens when things happen in the community and you're not there, to protect the community, then we feel we have to protect ourselves. So if I don't feel I can call the police in my community, that means I gotta protect myself, which means if the bad guy got a pistol, I got a pistol. But now everybody considered bad guys because we all got pistols, right? So, my goal, one of the things I try to do is just get them to see that, like get them to see our side. And also we try to look at things from their side because I understand like how, you know, at least to what degree I can, how, I try to understand what they're feeling and what they're going through as well, right? And it's kind of like, it's hard that if your everyday job is to see nothing but the worst of people, right? And that's gotta be hard on your spirit. And so we try to identify with that, and in us identifying with each other, it actually creates a bond. Because I'm seeing beyond the badge, and they're seeing beyond the prison sentence. And it just makes us human. And so the more that we can dialogue, the more that we have these dialogues. And you know, I got some of my call, like hang out with, it's like, yeah, we're just able to move beyond some of the things that, that limit us, at least in our personal interaction, and the hope that as we move forward, that those interactions with them will rub off on other police officers. And then obviously I'm going back and I'm working with people in my community and talking to young people as well. Did that answer you?
I kind of wonder, you know, how effective it is because I've seen people who are, you know, so as always siding with the police, you know, like during Black Lives Matter, that they were saying, "Oh, police lives matter," as if people were saying, you know, everybody, weren't saying everybody's lives matter. There's a kind of divide, just as there is in this country with
absolutely
every issue.
Right.
You know, I hope that what you're doing, the kind of work you're doing will spread and, you know, give police and the community a chance to, you know, to see more of a clear path to working together.
And that's why I come out like here to do and have these conversations because it's all of our work, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that, I think a lot of times when people don't want to hear Black Lives Matter, it's almost like I don't want to see the problem, right? Because what happens to the least of us happens to the best of us, right? And so if I can't see the racism that's in this country, then I don't have to face my stuff. I don't have to face the legacy that was left behind. I don't have to face what, and this word really bothers me, but people are privilege, right? I don't have to face that. It's just I don't really have to take a look in the mirror to see. And some people, I don't want to give up my privilege. So I don't want to look at it. Right? And I say that, with as much compassion as I can because I know from my own personal experience how hard it is to look in the mirror. Right? How hard it is to go on that psychological journey and be like, wow, I really hurt some people deeply. And I can see that in my own life and how much harder that must be to realize. And I'm going to say this, so forgive me, but as Europeans who came here and colonized this country, the amount of people that were hurt, murdered, and tortured, that has got to be heavy on people's spirit. And so what does that make me? If my people did this. So I know it has to be a lot of psychological things that's like blocking people from wanting to see that. Right? And so, you know, how do we have compassionate conversations so that that can happen? How do we realize that as much pain that came from the people who were slaves, pain had to come from the people who made them slaves. Because you don't get to treat people bad unless you got something going on inside of you. The only way that I could treat people bad was I had to make people other than human. I had to make people something else. I had to objectify or thinkify them. I had to turn them into something else. So So I called him different names. I called him different stuff. You punk, you this, you that, you whatever. I had to make him something other than human in order to do that. And that was my own sickness. Right? But me realizing that, right, and me really taking that deep journey inside, part of my, the last part of my, like, being in lockup and going through that after I made that, that first discovery, was I really went on that deep psychological journey inside. And at the end of the day, I found somebody that I loved and respect. I found somebody that I actually understood what he had went through. And I was able to look at myself objectively. Not saying everything got fixed in that moment, but I was really able to look at it and see, like, wow, I just was a hurt kid. Right? I'm not these bad things that people are saying.
It's so important to learn how to love yourself at the same time as being honest with what you've done.
Absolutely. And we all have to. Mm-hmm. And being honest with what you did, like, I think there's a lot of shame in it. And whenever there's shame, shame is about who we think we are. Shame is about identity. Right? And so we have to be able to separate. I had to be able to separate what I did from who I am. And I think we need that in this country. We have to be able to separate what people did from who they are now. I don't know how that's going to happen, but I think a lot of these conversations help. Yes, here and then I'll come back to
you. Well, first, let me just say thank you again for sharing your story with us. This is a gift of incredible value to everybody who hears it. Just a quick anecdote, and I do have a question. When you talked about how so many white people now are saying, how did things suddenly get so much worse? I heard a conversation the other day where somebody said, why is there suddenly so much more police violence against people of color?
Mm-hmm.
And somebody else in the conversation said, no, there's not more violence against people of color. There's more cameras.
Right.
You're finding out about something that's been going on for a long time.
Right.
But my question is, given the... Your analogy with the Chevrolet factory that produces cars that 70% of them fall apart and have to come back and be repaired. I mean, that analogy with the correction system, the Department of Corrections, right? You're supposed to be correcting things. It seems to generate, among other things, a very strong internal sort of cynicism within the people who are running the prisons. And I'm wondering about your experience in particular. I mean, you're an extreme example of somebody who really did go through a transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And you, as you told us about today, what kind of a reception did you get from the parole board when you were explaining that to them?
You know, first thing I want to say is that very seldom do I go places and talk that I don't eventually end up mentioning Warden Ayers or Lieutenant Robinson. These are two people that who believed in me when nobody else did. Like, they allowed me to do things as inside of San Quentin that especially the warden who set up stuff for us to run around and film, you know, and keep in mind this is like precedent, like what inmates get to run around with cameras on the yard, right? And the guards are like, what the hell? you know. So and the lieutenant absolutely supported us hands down. Like, we wouldn't have a third of the programs that we have there, but for people like him and his support. So I just wanted to put that out there. But initially, I think the more people tell me I left prison before I left prison. And I think the more that I freed my own mind inside and I still got some freeing to do, so I'm not trying to make it seem like I've arrived somewhere, right? so I'm trying to work my best around this English language, but people say I left prison before I left prison. And I think the more that I was able to free myself from all my mental, not all, but from certain mental restraints that I had in my own mind, that when I walked into that boardroom, my attitude was that they're going to learn something from me today. Right? And so I wasn't going in there to impress the board. I wasn't going in there with this hierarchy that, you know, Lord, you know, my life is in your hands kind of deal. I was going to go tell my story as I understood it. Right. And even if I didn't go home, they were going to learn something from me that day. So I just went in there with that. And I don't want to make it seem like I was arrogant, because I was, it's a very humbling situation. Right. But I went in there with the attitude that I was just going to go share my story. And that's what it was for me. My biggest fear, which I didn't tell my daughter the last two times that I went, is that having to come back and get on the phone. You know, cause I figure I'm an old tough soldier, right? And, I can take a lot. But having to come back and explain to my daughter that I wasn't coming home, and hearing the way her voice cracked, and them, her not understanding the system, I wasn't gonna do that. So my thing was, I'm just not gonna, say anything. And so walking into the board, I just started to tell my story, and they would ask me trick questions. Like, they started off, it was very hostile when they started off. And I'm saying hostile because I also know that the board has a tough job. Like, the weight is on them that if I let the wrong guy out and this guy goes to hurt somebody, then what? Right? So I want to acknowledge that. And so a lot of times I think that they'll act a certain way to see how you're going to respond. It's that test, right? If I argue with you and you argue back, you ain't ready, right? And so when I came in, it was very hostile at first. And they asked me the question. They said, Mr. Williams, you left out that day. Did you expect anybody to get hurt? And I laughed, right? And it's like, you laugh. What are you laughing in the boardroom, right? I laughed because I said, sir, it would be absolutely ridiculous for me to tell you that four armed men left with pistols and didn't expect that somebody might get hurt that day. And after that, everything flipped. Like, everything just flipped because that was true. And I think that they want to hear stuff that's true, that resonates with them as truth. Early on, I had an inability to move beyond certain things because it's like, if I say the wrong thing, I'm never going home. So I was more worried, that fear, that emotion, that stuff that you go through, right? It actually blocks you from being in your authentic self. And so the moment that I walked in and I'm in fear that if I say the wrong thing, I'm going home. Now my mind starts to guess what they want to hear instead of me speaking my truth. So I just went in, I'm going to speak my truth. This is my truth. Whether you like it or not, it's my truth. And so who can argue with my truth? You know, but I also had to understand my truth. Also, I had to get to a point, and this is where the practice came in, is just me, just that deep reflection. When I go through stuff, I don't run from it. I don't run from it. If I'm going through something, I go sit with it, and I'll be like, what are you trying to tell me? Yes.
I also want to thank you for coming here and sharing your experiences and your life with us. It's wonderful to hear. I'm curious, do you have a current meditation practice? Or are you a member of any group? Or do you have a daily practice?
I have a daily practice. On most occasions, I'll go sit at the East Bay Meditation Center. A group of us, I want to say maybe 20 or 30 of us, which were former volunteers and former incarcerated men went up to Green Gulch. So that's my mothership right there, for lack of a better term. We went up and sat it, had a day long at Green Gulch. And, Imola, Sato Lee DeBarros, Juryu, those are some of the founding people who helped start the, it was both inside and outside people who started the Buddha Dharma Sangha, at San Quentin. And so Carl, Ed, some of the original guys too that have come home, we all just went and, sat. Up at Green Gulch. So I try to make it down there as much as I can. I have a very busy schedule right now. I took I have 5 classes and I work. So I have a very busy workload this semester, which I'm not going to do next semester. But I practice daily, like, and sometimes it's like, things happen and I want to understand them. I want to be, and by understanding, I mean really just try to find my peace with it, with certain things that happen, or just me just reflecting on my day. I'll often sit at the end of the day and I'll say, like, what were my interactions like on this day? What are things that I can appreciate about it? And what are things that maybe I want to do differently? Or if my practice has gotten such now that if I'm having something happens, I have a conversation with you, I might think a certain way. I might not say it. And people outside of me may not even know that this is going on in my head. But if I realize that something went on in my head, that I don't like the character of what went on in my head, I sit with that. Because the more that I can sit with it, then I can make peace with it, and I can remove that pull from my mind. I can remove that pull from my life. Like that is what has enabled me, even with all the self-help groups and everything else. Like the foundation of it all is me being able just to sit with stuff. When I have an emotion or things come up, like I can sit with it. I remember my first time sitting with something happened in early on, and somebody said something to me, and I went ballistic. And in that moment, you know, something happens in the moment, and in the moment you're like, I shouldn't be doing this, but I can't stop. And so it's like, oh goodness. So I went back later and I would sit with it, and I actually was able to kind of detach myself from it. And I remember that this is the first time it happened. I'm sitting up and I'm looking at the incident and I'm like, look at that fool. Like this is an old fool, but it's me I'm talking about. And I realized that I'm so disconnected, not disconnected in the bad sense, but I'm like have this like, while I'm watching me interact and I'm not like attached to what's going on in that moment, I'm just watching it as an observer. And it's like watching somebody else do something, and you know, cause as humans, we can look at other people and we'll be like, yeah, look at dude, he looking like this, he like this. We can break their whole psychology down, everybody else. But like, I want to learn to do that for me, for my own psychology, for my own mind. And that's what I try to use my practice for. That's part of my daily practice. Thank you. And then I come in.
What was the Sangha like in the prison? Did you have a teacher?
Sato Lee DeBarros was our main, the Zen priest at, from Green Gulch. Yes. And Imola, I've learned so much from Imola as well.
Like, do you have a sitting every?
So, every week, every Sunday, the Sangha sits. The Sangha sits from 6 to 8 every week, and basically the guys will come over, you know, we'll lay out the Sangha, and our Sangha, we face each other, we face in the circle, and we'll sit, have a Dharma talk, and just mingle afterwards. In a nutshell. Yes. Her back there, indeed. Yes.
Leslie, thank you so much for being here this morning. It's a gift to me to hear you speak.
Thank you.
I'm curious about the time you talked about being in the cell, in the confinement, and the list that you wrote. When you wrote your name, can you talk a little bit about what was that moment like for when you wrote your name? And what are some of the tools you used to be able to leap forward and see your part in what was going on?
Right. So, in the moment, I guess it's a, I don't know, what comes to mind is kind of profound shock. It's like, wow, like this is deep. Like I made this, like it's the aha moment. Like I really, like I'm connected in some way to all, it's like this is to be, it's like the beginning of my journey now. Like I have to go on this mission now, and it's a mission that I readily accept. Like I'm so glad that I found that moment. And I think some of the tools. So when I sit, and I know, you know, depending on, you know, there are a lot of different traditions, right? And one of the, I read this book. It's called the Metunetus, and it talks about an ancient African tradition of meditation. And not that I can call out all the different, you know, traditions, but whether we're talking Zen or Vipassana or the different styles, I sort of relate that to what I got out of this book. And sometimes I'll just focus on my breath. Sometimes I'll just sit with my breath. Sometimes I'll sit with an emotion. So if something happens and sometimes I can't name the exact emotion, but that feeling that happens, I'll just sit with that feeling and I'll try to engage that feeling as much as I can. And eventually, for lack of a better way, it will talk to me. Like it will inform me of what's behind it. There are times that I just, like, I do my controlled breath. So I'll do a four count where I just slow my breath down. I'll count four in and I release four. And I'll just sit with that as long as I can. And there are times that I watch my thoughts. I just entertain what comes through my mind. That actually helps me to steal my mind at times. Because I realize that we don't necessarily control our thoughts. So if I told you, don't focus on the light behind me, right? No, seriously, don't focus on the light. Everybody, stop paying attention to the light. Right? And the more I say it, the mind goes, oh, right? Right? And so I just notice how what I'm not in control of, which actually allows me to see what I am in control of. And so I think those are some of the basic tools that I use. And I use them depending on what comes up for me. But probably the most powerful is has been the slowing my breath down, because that deep sense of calm. In fact, I like to do that first. Is it really? One of the methods, and this came from the ancient African tradition too. But one of the methods is like by when we are able to slow ourselves down, we actually send ourselves into a really like trance kind of meditative state. And it's in that meditative state where you are most conducive for growth. And so when I can slow my breath down and slow myself down and almost get into that meditative state, or get in that state, then what I'll do is I'll start to focus on that sensation or that emotion or that thing that is going on with me, and then it starts to inform me about whatever it is that's happening. And it's not always something bad either. It might be some good stuff, or it might just be me just enjoying something too. Yes. Yes.
I know that part of why the Sangha brought you here is we want to think of ways that we can get involved in society and do some things. Mm-hmm. And what are your thoughts about what we as a Sangha, like some steps we could take to get more involved in the societal problems and a solution? I mean, that's just a way to start.
Yeah, I think this, I don't know how many of these talks or these things you do, but I think us getting to know each other, right? I think that's a big thing. Like, you fear what you don't know. And I think the more that we can just learn to know each other, and it's not to say, like, you know, I don't want to, like, I think there's a way of us building up to a point where we can actually not only just get to know each other, but really be truthful about our history, be truthful about what's happening, and be I guess compassionate with each other in the way that we have those discussions and look at things, and be like when things happen that are happening in society, or something happens, or you see an injustice, or you see something that's going on, are you quiet about it, or do you talk about it? And if so, why or why not? And I think there's, I guess I'm trying to, like, I believe in balance, and I'm trying to look at the balance of things, because I've also seen, on one hand, I've seen somebody clearly be doing something wrong, and then people automatically, like, be on the police about something that's happening. Well, the guy actually just socked the lady in the face. I think he should be put in the back of a car, right? It's like sometimes we'll reach overboard. You know, if you understand what I'm saying. So, but like, how do we like find that balance? How do we have these discussions about what's really going on in our society from a really clear perspective? When something wrong or something goes on in society, am I quiet about it? Do I speak out about it? How do I speak out about it? If I'm seeing that this school where all the black kids are at have no resources, and yet this school right across the street where all the white kids are at have all the brand new computers and everything, like, that's an injustice in our society that needs to be addressed. And maybe I'm putting too something big out there, but I know that there's a lot of structural things that are in place, and sometimes it's easier to focus on individuals and say, well, look at Obama, he became president, and yet more black people got killed under Obama's administration than at any one period than in history. You know, yes. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Thank you.
When you were talking about discussions and understanding other people, I'm just curious, from your perspective, have you seen the Netflix series Orange is the New Black?
Yes.
It's fictional, but, you know, I think they're trying to tell individual stories so that you understand why they've been incarcerated. And mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, from your perspective, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's difficult when people ask, I've asked this question a couple of times, and it's difficult for me to speak on women's prison and women's issues because I just don't know. I mean, you know, I have a lot of women friends who have come home too, and they're home from prison, but I don't know how, as far as what they actually go through from their perspective in their prison, I would be hesitant to speak on that, because I don't have that experience. But I think that, I think in some ways, all of these little things sort of add to the conversation. I think what's missing from a lot of conversations is that we don't actually hear the voice of the person who's most impacted or the people who are most impacted. I think that's why I'm a little, I'd be a little hesitant to speak on the women and the women issues, like directly from that perspective, because, I think that's for them to speak on.
Yeah, but I just felt like it seems like it's an attempt to more humanize the people, like telling an individual story. It's all fictional, I know, but there's, you know, people might just look at the crime and not realize all the history that might have led up.
Right. I don't know. I hear your question. I think I hear your question, and I think I have to like look at that a little bit more because. I think I've watched a few pieces of it. I mean, the series of it. And parts of it seem like really, comical. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure how I feel comedy really addresses situations like that. Does it actually allow us to see in or connect more, or does it actually disconnect us more? I don't know if I have an answer to that question. I have to think about that. Good question, though. You're going to make me go home and meditate about that. Thank you. Yes. Yes.
So we share a last name, but our circumstances are so different. And I wanted to let you know how inspiring you are. I think that we think of bodhisattva as a noun, but I think it's actually a verb. Mm. And I think that it's a work. And watching and listening to your story about how much effort you've put into it, it's really inspiring. You've had so much to overcome, and you're such an exemplar of the way. Even listening to you talk about your own struggle with right thinking. And right speaking and right practice. And I wonder too, your own experience makes you such an accessible agent for change in your own community. Mm-hmm. Because people can relate to you and they can respect you for the experiences you've had. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how I can help without being an outsider, as someone with a lot of privilege with a different history. Like, I would feel really awkward showing up at prison and saying, "Look, I got this. Like, what you need is to wake up. I'm going to show you how to do it. I just have to sit down. I know this is going to be hard."
Exactly.
maybe what I'm trying to say is maybe if I'm looking around for my own in-group, it's the people who are afraid. Mm-hmm. People who are trying to lock people up. Maybe it's the people who are arguing for the three strikes law. Maybe it's those people that I need to be waking up. I don't know what you think.
I think we need to be in all areas. Like our we have to look at this, in my opinion, in a very holistic way. And it's like I think somebody mentioned earlier about the issue of the things that police go through. Like, they need to be looked at with compassion as well, right? And the person who comes in, like, "I'm going to help make you better," they don't do too well. right? I'm just saying, though, they don't do too well. But it's the person that comes in, even though our circumstances are very different, we all have universal emotions. And we all know what true is. We all know what real is. Right. And I tell people this. I say that my first time sitting one of the self-help classes, the lady came in and she says, "So how are you feeling?" Right. And I'm like, "What the hell are you talking about?" Like, I did not have a vocabulary for my emotions. I knew angry. I knew sad. Yeah, I knew words. Right. But how to relate those words to my own true emotions, I did not have a vocabulary for that. Like, I didn't know how at all. And so having people that could like model their own emotions and just be real. Like, we would sit in a group with some people, and we'd be in this group for 6 months and they've never had a problem. How you doing today? All is well. Things are tripping, you know. And they trying to show their best side, right? In actuality, what you're telling me is that you're lying to me. Right? Because we're human. And we know, I got enough sense to know that every human being goes through something. And so if people who say they never, I never get angry. No, we do get angry. Like it's a natural emotion. It's what you do with that anger that makes it good or bad or makes it right or wrong or that makes it whatever. Right? But it's not that the fact that we cannot deny. My problem early on was that I was denying that I was feeling stuff. And as I learned that you cannot suppress what you feel because it will come to the surface. And so having people that can do that, that can like, just, you know, be real, like just share life. Like it gives others permission to be in their real self or in their true self. Because we've had people that come in and be like, look, I'm going to tell y'all like this. I don't know what going on. I don't know anything about this. I know what I've been through. I know my life and I can tell you that. But it's some things like that they have to learn from us. That's why a lot of the programs inside, there's often an outside facilitator and there's an inside facilitator. Right? Because and I tell people this, that I've had to walk in a room, even before I had a vocabulary, I've had to walk into a room and instantly know the heartbeat of that room because my life depended on it. Mm-hmm. I may not have a vocabulary for it, but I can look at people and I can sense the slightest body suggestive language that there may be is to assess is this safe for me or not. My life is dependent on me knowing that, right? And so we're keenly aware. We're more aware than your average human being about emotions and about situations. The problem is that in many cases we're not fully conscious. It's just that instinct. And we don't necessarily have a vocabulary for it in many cases, right? And so when people can come in and they can model that vocabulary and not like in this condescending way, but just like being real, you know, with what it is, and we learn to appreciate that. Like we love that. We love that because and then it's like they learn from us, we learn from them, and this is learning situation, and we both are built up. And that's what life is about. It's not about somebody coming in believing that they have all the answers, because we quickly shut people down like that. Okay, you say you got all the answers. I'm going to let you pretend you have all the answers, and I'm going to sit here and pretend at the end of the day, you get to feel good. I get to feel good because I walk away with a chrono, and I have to take that chrono to the board. And you get to pretend like you're doing good for society. And nothing ever really changes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Okay, I want to acknowledge you for the work you're doing. And there's nothing that I can say that you don't already know. And I know that you know it because you're doing this work. But I just want to say it anyway, that there's a lot of distorted media. Mm-hmm. From the time we are children, like you mentioned, the textbooks, they're always written by the person who wins. Mm-hmm. There's a lot missing there. Mm-hmm. And I know that the people who came here from Africa were free people. Mm-hmm. They were not slaves. We didn't bring slaves here. They were free people with rich cultures, nobility, with music, with dance, with strong spirituality, and they were forced into slavery and forgot who they were. And that remembrance of who the African people are is so important. And not just that, but you talked about like being with your own truth and saying, no one can argue with my truth. And that is so big, because when you're with your personal truth, the little details of your life, you're with the universal truth.
Absolutely.
And you got the backing of Martin Luther King. You got the backing not just of black heroes, but of Jesus Christ, of Suzuki Roshi. Everyone who has committed their life to truth is backing with you, and you're one with them. Every time you engage in truth. And what we need, this is exactly what we need, is to hear people's stories. Because we don't get it just hearing some statistic or why we should do this or that. Like, it's the details of your individual story that makes people get it, you know? Yeah. What you're doing is so important.
Absolutely.
It's you're changing the world in this moment.
Absolutely.
And there was something else I wanted to say. I can't remember right now. but what you're doing is really powerful. You're really a big inspiration. And, you know, keep going, man. Like, keep growing.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you. Yes. Yes.
I also wanted to ask you, when you work with young people, what sort of situation, you know, at-risk young people to help them? Because like, that's the future. I think it's so important that we do this in our society.
So I work with young people in a lot of different, like, capacities. On the bad end of it is that last Monday I went into, I was called up by the probation department to go in and speak with a young kid in juvenile hall who was sentenced to life in prison. And he is worried about how he's going to survive. In prison. The sad part is that, he's been in juvenile hall for 2.5 years. He's 19 now. He took a lady's life. I can see his, like, remorse, which doesn't, it doesn't alter what he did. And he has to go face his situation, right? So, and I'm a person who, even though, like, I believe in restorative justice, I believe in that, I'm not someone who will say that actions are not without consequences. So he has to go face the music, so to speak. The good part is that I was able to present to him as a living example of what he can make it through. And so he saw that. Like, I'm like, I was on that side. Like, I was, like, on that side, in that stool, with that attitude. Right? And look at me. I got a little gray on my chin, but I'm good. I'm in good shape. I'm loving life. And I'm living the life I want to live now. So you got some things to go face. And yet, even as you go face them, there's a lot of good that you can do while you're going to face them. So you can actually go into prison and be influenced by what's around you, or you can go and influence what's around you. And you have to make that up in your mind, what you're going to be and how you're going to be it. So he's a writer. He wants to write. He wants to do stuff like that. So I expect to be hearing from him and getting some more writings from him. And I was just telling him how, even at a young age, even him going in there, for him to be able to write, because we was able to dig, like, I was only with him 2 hours, but we was able to really have some really deep conversations about his life, what led him to that point. And he sees a lot. Like, he really sees a lot more than what I expected that he was going to see in this situation. But he's been doing a lot of reflecting and a lot of thinking while he's in there. So I gave him a few breathing exercises, and we went through that and was able to calm down. He was able to really dig deep. I told him I hope to hear from him, that his, some of his writings help hopefully go on and change some other people's lives who might be headed in his direction. So that's kind of like the worst end of the stick. And just yesterday, I had a couple of conversations with a couple of young men who, they're part of this YEP program, and they do, like, housing repair, and they're working on some stuff in the basement of a house where I'm living at. And I was just able to go talk to some of the young men there, because a lot of it, like, you know, I developed this program that I use in juvenile facility called Project Emerge. I do that. But a lot of what happens, I like more the, outside of just these formal things that happen, because it's just about having a conversation and identifying with them. So what I quickly try to do is assess what type of logic are people using to stay in a situation, right? What is the reasoning that an individual is giving for being the way that they are? And then I battle the logic instead of the person, right? And it seems to work. The youngster yesterday, he was having some girlfriend problems and all that old other stuff. And then I saw him later that day with his girlfriend. He was like, this is her right here, right? So, I was like, okay, come here, you two. it's beautiful to see them. And then they started talking and communicating. So I just love that part of it. Yeah.
So many of us feel so moved by, you know, the situations that you've presented to us. Yeah. We really, it would be like an extension of our practice, you know, we could do even one little thing.
So I keep hearing that question, and I think, so this is what's coming to mind now, and maybe something else might come and somebody ask me again, but I think trying to understand what the needs of your community. Like, what are the needs in this community, right? And also, I want to say that it's not just, like, I come to a lot of places and it's almost like, I hope this don't sound like wrong, so forgive me if it comes off wrong. I don't mean it like that. So sometimes I have to do that because I don't have a different way of trying to explain stuff. But sometimes I walk in some places and it's like everybody wants to, so to speak, go adopt the African baby, right? So to speak, right? And it's like, sometimes it's not the baby who needs adopting. Sometimes it's the parent that needs adopting, right? And sometimes it's not just going into the black communities to do the work, but sometimes it's going into the white communities to figure out what's going on there, right? And so I don't know what the capacity of the individuals are that's here, that's in the group, but I guess one thing comes to mind is really maybe start conducting a survey and have people just start to look around and see what are the needs of this community with regards to some of the things that's happening. If it's along racial lines or racial harmony or people's attitudes towards certain things, I don't know what the issues are in this community, but I think that's the first thing, is maybe taking a look at what some of the needs are, and then from that figuring out a plan. And how to move forward as a, adopting one, that one thing that everybody can get on board with.
There's such a need for it. I mean, the country is so polarized right now. And how do you talk to the people, even, you know, the white people who have these very hard-lived income
things? Right.
You know, and it's not even easy for us, you know, sometimes to face a neighbor or, you know, a co-worker
has
that kind of attitude without making, you know, making it seem like we're, you know, we're blaming them.
Absolutely.
I'm just at such a loss. I don't even know how to talk to people in my own neighborhood anymore.
Right. And maybe that's part of it. Maybe that's part of it, is sitting and figuring out how do we have them, how do we have conversations to where we don't alienate people, but allow people to have them conversations. Like, you know, I love the idea and bring Mary Jane in this, but Mary Jane has this little thing where she brings different people in the community together to start having them conversations. Like, I love that idea, and that's why I come to as many of her events as I can. Is that I think that's one way, or just and maybe that's some of the conversation, right? Because I also don't want to, like, I don't have all the answers. Like, I don't. Like, but I'm willing to help us, like, I'm willing to be that one of the people to say, let's figure it out. You know what I mean? And I think together we can figure it out. Like, when great minds come together, great things happen. You know? And I'm in for the journey. I'm in for the long haul.
Thank you.
All right. You remember?
I remember. Okay. Sorry. So you know how you were talking about if that guy got another gun and I need to protect myself, then I need a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is what's happening on a societal level,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's due to the media and what's put out there. There's these dangerous criminals, these dangerous illegal immigrants. They're mm-hmm. snatching up your jobs, and that kind of media forces it evokes fear,
right.
which then goes to build more prisons, which
right.
is all a business and all about making money.
Yeah.
And also, even the send the people back, send the immigrants back. That's a business too.
Yeah.
Making money off of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important, both with what we were saying, like how do we help in our own communities and also the people who end up actually going to prison and these things. It's like to start really getting the truth out there. What are these systems actually doing?
Yeah.
What's under the hood?
Yeah.
Why are they still functional? And all the distortions that are put out there.
Yeah.
You know, because actually the truth is a lot of these people that are fearful or privileged or whatever, they're being manipulated.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Give me your money because I'm going to keep you safe.
Absolutely. And that's what happened after. So, and I don't know how many people know this, and I'm assuming there are some good scholars in the room, but after, originally slavery in this country was not about color, right? There were white slaves, there were black slaves, there were indigenous servitude, right? It happened in this country. And what happened is that a lot of rebellions start to happen on plantations. And these rebellions were not just, regardless of what the media said, was not just black people rebelling, but it was slaves and indigenous servitudes who started to rebel against the 1% of that time, right? And so as a way of changing the systems around, or changing things around, they started to become about color. Because it was easy if, you know, if a white slave, you know, escaped, he's kind of hard to pick out of the crowd, right? But if a black guy escaped, then, you know, it's a little easier to figure out. We just make all black people like slaves. Also, it also became that, okay, now what we're going to do for you, the poor people, is that we're going to make you the overseers of these people. And so now you actually get paid to perpetuate the system. And if you look at what's happening, if you look at even with some of our officers or certain things that are happening, I think deep down in certain officers' hearts, like they don't believe in what's happening, but it's my job.
Mm-hmm. Divide and conquer.
It's my job, yeah. And right, so it's like, how do we, like, and this is, I think, just too, it's a large question, and sometimes it can be, like, daunting, but how do we fix that? You know, like, and that's maybe too big of a question, but I just wanted to share that piece right there. Yeah.
Well, can I just, mm-hmm. So what you just brought up is, what they did is they divided. They said this group of people is different.
Yep.
But they can't divide and conquer if you're not divided.
Right.
So, like, if we reestablish that connection,
right.
then we won't be turn on each other.
Absolutely.
Much.
Absolutely, and the connection that needs to be established is not just our emotional connection and our intellectual connection, but our economic connection. Like, there's a lot of other facets that really play into that big pie. But I agree. Yep. All right. Have I worn people down yet? Thank you.
I want to say thank you to my friend Mary Jane, who is here, and she was the one who introduced me to Troy. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time, the day I met you, I just didn't speak much to you, but there were a few mm-hmm. things you said that really stayed with me,
mm-hmm.
and I thought it would be nice you came to talk here to mm-hmm. us, and it was really wonderful to hear
mm-hmm.
your story today and how strong you came of this struggle and how you're being a game changer now. So thank mm-hmm. you very much.
Thank you.
And we have a few presents for you from our Sangha.
Wow.
Thank you.
What, did I open it?
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, please.
Well, one thing was my opinion
this was just myself, I felt like you were kind of hard on yourself when you said that you spoke your truth and they could feel that because you had spoken your truth before and you kind of got that was courageous to then speak your truth again. Right. And my question is, you said you felt like you were the black sheep when you were a child. And
say that
the
one.
Black sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And your dad, and you had problems with your dad and your mom. And I wondered, has that changed at all? Or?
I mean, you know, being away for all that time, like, I realized this much, that my parents could only give me what they had, right? My mother is like, her unconditional love, like I would not be the man I am but for her, having her like stick with me the way that she did. Like she is an example of unconditional love. Like she never wavered, not a thought of wavering. She stuck by me. And so I love her for that. I realized that when I learned about my father and I learned what he had went through, in life growing up, my heart like went out for him, what he went through. And, I accept that some things aren't going to change with him. I know he loves me. Our ability to communicate beyond certain things is just, I don't know if they ever will be, that. And I just have to love him and accept him for who he is. You know, he didn't have much of an education growing up either, but, you know, I look for the things that are brilliant in him, and there's nothing that man can't build. Like he's, you know, and I've just seen it over my lifetime. He'd show up on a construction site and with whoever, and before you know it, he's running the construction site because he knows his stuff, you know. So there's a brilliance, but it's that emotional connection that, you know, I probably was in my late 40s, that I recall one time in my childhood that he told me he loved me. And in my late 40s, he started telling me he loved me. And it's hard for me to hear that from him. It's difficult to hear it. And yet I know he does. He just hasn't known how to express it. And now I'm going through my own stuff, trying to relate to it. You know? But thank you. Yes. I'm trying not to tear stuff. Wow, this is going up.
Wow. Oh, is that the precepts that we have then in the Sangha room too? No feeling life and then cultivating and encouraging life, like the positive version of it.
I love it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's what I need. You must know what I needed for my walls and my, you know, bear and stuff. Absolutely.
Thank you.